Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can all go to once a week whenever it is movie night. Interesting people pop in to rent something, and we go through the films that they've loved across their life, and then when the store is quiet, I chat to my buddies about the films that we're watching on streaming platforms and out in cinemas. We're here to help you figure out what you can watch. All right, let's start the show. Let's open up the shop. Good morning, guys.
Hi.
Morning, Russell.
How are you, Graham?
All right, and yourself, dude?
Yeah, cool, man. It's nice to see you.
Nice.
How are you, Cole?
I'm all right.
And you, and a little British.
Yeah.
And hello to you listening. Welcome to the video store. We have ourselves a fabulous day here. It's movie weather
here
in Joburg. Yeah. So we're here to help you figure out what you can watch. One of which...
While we cuddle on the couch with a blankie.
Precisely.
Yeah.
One of the things you could be watching is Showmax original Catch Me a Killer, which is a very, very smart, very well-made show about the evolution of detectiving.
Detectiving?
Detectiving. Similar to Mindhunter, where psychological profiling of serial killers was starting to make its way into South Africa. Mm. And Miki Pistorius was the psychologist who was there at the forefront in the 90s, who wrote
the textbook
on it, and was really able to bring that knowledge into South Africa, or into the South African cases that were happening, and was instrumental in helping us find serial killers in the 90s and onwards.
Wild.
And wrote this book, Catch Me a Killer, which has been adapted into a show. The lead of that show is a woman called Charlotte Hope, who I have the opportunity of meeting in a moment.
Nice.
So lucky. She's going to pop in to rent something, which is really special.
That's cool.
Because she was also on Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
So it's going to be very cool to get to know her, talk to her. So in a moment, she's going to pop in. But for all of those joining us for the first time in our lovely day here at the video store, after the chat with Charlotte, myself, Cole, and Graham are going to chat about all the things we're watching.
Hmm. Yeah.
We've been lucky enough to go to some advanced screenings, so we get a chance to see these films before others, which is really cool. One of which is Monkey Man,
nice,
which is now in cinemas, including the Bioscope. So I want to talk about that.
Now there's Godzilla X Kong, the cool. New Empire.
Yeah. Cool. Be nice to talk about that.
And Three Body Problem on Netflix.
Yes. Yes. We've got to get into that.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
All right. So there's lots to talk about. I also want to get into the fact that we are now at our 99th episode.
Oh.
Next week is going to be our 100th, which is going to be a very special episode.
We're getting old.
But at this point, there's a very exciting evolution, which I want to propose to you listening and to you guys.
Am I getting a promotion?
Hopefully.
Yeah. Is there budgets?
No. a very exciting, I think, new chapter of the video store, which I want us to get into. And so we'll talk about that at the very end.
Cool.
But I think let's waste no more time.
Yeah.
Do we all have something that we can keep ourselves busy with when Charlotte arrives?
I've still got like 99 tapes to go through. You know, when you lift the flap at the back and go to get the dust out.
Right. Yeah. Okay, you're going to do that, Graham?
Yeah. I'm going to go explain to those teenagers over there that Naked Lunch isn't what they think it is.
Naked Lunch? What is Naked Lunch?
It's a Cronenberg movie.
Oh, shit. Anyone about to get into Cronenberg is in for a treat. All right, let's do it. This is Charlotte Hope popping in to rent something. Welcome to the video store.
Thanks for having me.
Did you get a bit of a breakdown about us? Do you know everything, or should I give you a little explanation?
I know nothing, and I tried to look you up on. I looked up video store, and I looked up Bioscope on my podcast, Apple podcast, because I always like to listen. Before, and I don't think it's you.
Okay.
What I found.
Okay.
So tell me, what is you?
So where I'm sitting right now is a cinema called The Bioscope. We've proudly been Johannesburg's independent cinema space for what's now almost 14 years, which is very exciting. And you are based in London now, hey? Where are you chatting to me from? So have you ever gone to the Prince Charles?
Yeah. I love the Prince Charles.
Okay, so we're perhaps kind of similar to that in spirit, where, you know, we can get a bit art house, we can get a bit cinema geek, but we're also like fun date night and sing-alongs and dress-ups and stand-up comedy, live music. And so we've started the video store because the word The Bioscope is a very old term. It's sort of what our grandparents used to refer to as the cinema. And now we're at that point where, you know, the video store is also quite an old term.
Yeah, so, I know, sadly.
Weird, right? And so The Bioscope, the video store are the sort of two things that go hand in hand. The video store being our podcast where we are pretending we are a video store. And so you have just walked in to visit us at our video store. So welcome.
Okay. So
welcome to it. This is also a nice challenge for me to keep it strictly to 40 minutes because because of the Zoom restrictions.
Oh yeah, of course.
Premium is quite expensive.
I
was considering taking it just so that I could not have this limit with you, but then I was like, oh god.
It's not cheap. That's how they hook you in, I think.
Yeah. So I think let's get straight into it. Catch Me a Killer is amazing.
Oh, thank you.
when did this come to you? When did you shoot it?
So I got sent the script in like June, July of 2022. And I read them. They were Amy Jeffter's first two episodes. I thought they were completely amazing and some of like the best scripts I'd read in like a long time. And so then I went for a meeting with the producers and I was like, oh my God, I love these scripts. I love this role. Please let me do it. And I thought from that first meeting, it had all gone quite well. And I was like, oh, maybe this is going to be very straightforward and they're just going to offer me the job and it would be, just very easy. But unfortunately, that didn't happen because that never happens for me. So instead, I made about like probably 8 audition tapes. I basically just like, they kept sending me new scripts and I would just record extra scenes and send them to the producers and be like, see, what about this bit? What about this bit? And then eventually they acquiesced and gave me the job, but it was it took a minute to try and
because it was a German co-production, right? Is that how the scripts were sort of floating around Europe?
I don't know because I'm not on the producing side, but I know that it was made in partnership with Night Train Media, who are based in Germany.
Okay,
but I don't know. I don't know that.
Okay,
but a mere actor.
Did you at that point, did you have any relationship with South Africa?
No, absolutely none. I'd read Mickey's book.
You'd read it before you got the script?
No.
Okay.
As a result of reading the script, I read the book. But no, I had no, like, I just knew that they were looking for like international artists as well as South African artists, and the pool was open. So
does Mickey have an English accent?
In our show, yes, not in real life.
Okay, I was curious because I was just curious who they were then looking for. Because obviously it tells the real life story of her. So no relationship to South Africa, which is amazing. So what was that like?
Yeah, well, so originally I thought I was going to be doing Mickey has a, like, is from Pretoria. She has an Afrikaans accent. So I really thought I was going into this doing
an accent.
Afrikaans accent, yeah. And I was working on it with my accent coach and everything. And Afrikaans is like, as an accent, is like fascinating. Yeah. I love working in accents. I'm a linguist. Like, I did French and Spanish at uni. So whenever I'm like offered an accent, I get really excited. But then it became very clear quite quickly that they didn't want me to do a South African accent.
It wasn't an issue. It wasn't needed because it's set up that you had traveled and that you'd spent some time overseas. And so that all made sense. It wasn't an issue.
Yeah. And I think they wanted Mickey to feel a bit like an outsider. She's a kind of like,
just a nice device.
And it was helpful in that sense. So
okay.
I was a bit sad, but I think probably it was for the best for the show.
And I think what's interesting is that not only were you brought into South Africa, but you were brought into a very interesting time stamp of South Africa, which, for me, I'm in my late 30s. So the 90s in South Africa is still like a memory I have. And I must just say they got it perfect in so many ways, like down to the phones that you use, like both the start of like the cell phone, but it wasn't the big clunky one. It was slightly smaller, but there's one particular phone that you use, like a landline phone. And we had the exact same phone. So it was like, it was really well done. And there was a shot also of the Joburg skyline, and one of our more iconic buildings is quite famous for having a cell phone brand on top of it as this kind of big billboard, but it didn't have that. So somebody took that shot and like CGI'd the modernness off it. And so it was just so great to see that detail, and all of that made Catch Me a Killer just such a confident show that you then just are so happy to go along with.
Like Warren Gray won an award for the production design, and it's funny because at the time, it is a period show. Like it's very much set in the 90s. To me, it felt like I spent so much time doing period drama that it felt like kind of modern and like normal. But that's also because I have some memory of the 90s. It didn't feel super alien. But I watch it back, and like lots of my friends are like, "Oh wow, no, this really feels very specifically 90s in a way that I think like." A lot of television kind of sometimes doesn't completely capture because the 90s don't feel like they should be a period drama essentially, but they are. Like it was,
it's amazing.
Yeah, it was so, so different. Yeah. But like it's also like a lot of the fashions come back. So like a lot of the clothes I was wearing, I was like, oh, I'm just taking these straight back into my real life. Like there was very little kind of differentiation. But yeah, no, I completely agree with you. Like our production design was.
It was lovely.
They were really phenomenal and really like got that kind of the specificity of that time.
And then just in the show itself, a bit more sink your teeth in, you developed a relationship with Mickey. Did you get to spend some time?
Yeah.
And apparently you needed her for some emotional support. Was it quite a taxing role in that sense?
Marcia's there here. So Mickey and I actually weirdly never met in real life. She lives in Mauritius and she was there right at the beginning of the prep, but not when I was there. But we talked loads on kind of WhatsApp and on the phone. And she was, to be honest, like more than anything was a kind of a friend to me throughout it. Like she was really sweet and really supportive and kind and just kind of took care of me, and whenever you know it was really taxing the role. Like Mickey herself kind of suffered some horrible PTSD after like working for that long in that kind of intense environment, and we were kind of portraying that unraveling essentially over the course of the 10 episodes. So there were certainly times where it got, you know, the lines get a little bit blurred. Like your body experiences trauma, even if it's pretend, you know, like
as an actor,
if you're crying, even if you know it's that, like it's, you know, you're crying because you're acting, your body doesn't know that.
Like, exactly. Your body's like, what's wrong?
Process.
Yeah.
It takes a physical, emotional, mental toll. And so Mickey really like throughout, cause I'd kind of sent her pictures from set. And there was one day specifically, like right at the beginning, actually, I guess this is really before it all started to unravel in a more serious way.
Yeah.
Like there was one scene right at the beginning where I, in the first episode, where I find this kind of like tiny hand.
The one in the beach.
And as I said, our
production
design was.
Yeah, yeah.
On the dunes, yeah.
Yeah.
Our production design was amazing, but like there was also very, you couldn't really get away from the fact that like this wasn't a prop. This was a, this hand had belonged to a real boy. Like that was a real child that had died and his hand was found. And it was kind of in that moment where it just like really hit me that we weren't just telling a kind of like a
play
like
story.
A crime story. Yeah. We were telling this story about like, you know, that boy's mother is probably still alive and still lives close to by where we're filmed. You know, it all got very, the proximity got very close. And I remember going home that night and I'd sent Mickey some pictures from set and she just said to me something like, you know, if you go too far into the abyss, you just tell me and I'll come in and get you. And that's kind of set us up for the whole of the show. Like whenever it got a bit too close, like where the line was, you know, I just got a bit too close to the line. I always knew that I had Mickey, who was, you know, an incredibly kind woman, but also was like a incredible psychologist.
Yeah, that's just don't forget that's what her profession is. You know? Yeah. So she could help you, yeah.
Yeah, and she really did. Because it would have, like, I'm not the kind of actor that can, like, just pick up and put stuff down. Like, I wanted to really do justice to the like what Mickey went through, but also what the victims and their families went through. You know, like it was pretty harrowing.
Yeah.
And just knowing that I had Mickey as support, but also honestly, like the whole crew really carried me. Like sometimes literally, but certainly metaphorically. I really couldn't have done it without them. Like I think South African crews are like famously some of the best in the world, but this one in particular, like even just hearing your accent makes me miss them so much.
when was the shooting?
Oh, sorry. Yes, I was going to tell you that.
Yeah,
beginning.
No. This is all great.
Filming August 2022, and September 2022, and we finished in like February 2023.
Okay. So it's quite a while. And have you not been back to South Africa since?
No, I would love to. I was really hoping we'd get to go back for like a premiere or something. But now I'm just praying that we get a second season and I get to go back. I adored South Africa.
I was about to say, I mean, is there more meat in the bone? Is there opportunity for more?
I mean, I hope so. Like, for me personally, I would like, do this job for the rest of my life. I really loved it so much, and there are certain.
Yeah, I'm afraid we haven't run out of crime stories in South Africa. So, I'm afraid to admit there's a lot more to do. Did you tell in this first season? Did you tell the majority of her book, or is there more in the book?
I think we've done most of the Catch Me a Killer. I think most of the stories in that book we told, but then Mickey's written like several other books.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. I've missed that part.
As you said, like I think in the 90s, when she was writing in the 90s, she said South Africa had the second highest rate of serial homicide, second only to America.
And there are 400 million, well, 300 million people.
They got a lot. Yeah,
it's hard, and I think South Africa also we struggle with that because we love a good true crime. You know, that kind of stuff's popular here and people love it. But it's been difficult to watch true crime that's South African because sometimes for a lot of people, it feels a little too close to home because we try and kind of give ourselves that space and rationalize how that crime happens in South Africa. So perhaps what's nice about this show is that it was a little while ago. So it can feel a bit distant, but... I think it is important, especially to come at it from the point of view of psychology so that we as South Africans can also try and understand what we're going through, what we're thinking, how these things happen, to kind of also rationalize it. Otherwise, it's just this kind of senseless violence.
Yeah, absolutely.
It gave it a lot of heart.
I mean, I think, yes, the what is it, 30 years of distance definitely helped. But like a lot of our crew... were from kind of had grown up in Mitchell's Plain and remembered like the Station Strangler case. Like it never, the violence that we were talking about kind of never felt abstract. It felt very like Amy Jefter, who wrote the first two episodes. I think she was kind of brought up in Mitchell's Plain and remember I remember talking to a lot of people and them all having very vivid memories of being kids around that time and the kind of the fear. And so, yeah, I think that there was a certain amount of perspective, but it was still, it still felt very close to the bone. And even like Norman Simons was released on parole in 2023. Like the whole thing.
That the haunting part of this show it hits you right at the end is, you know, the fact that you've just watched this whole thing about the serial killer being caught. And then at the end of this show, you're like, oh, he was released last year. And you're like, oh, God.
We were filming in Parle as well.
That person's walking amongst us. It's wild. But listen, we'd like to take a little journey now, just as a way to get to know you. We want to just take a little snapshot through your life. Because at the video store, we've got the four great loves that we call, which are the films that you've loved across your life. And we think it kind of helps sort of paint a picture of yourself. We think the films that you've loved say a lot about you. So I'd like to get going on that. The first film we have is your puppy love film, which is the film that perhaps came to you in sort of early childhood, primary school. Where did we grow up?
So, okay, I grew up in the middle of nowhere. This is gonna unfortunately inform some of my choices.
Lovely.
So, I grew up in like deepest, darkest countryside in like the New Forest, like Dorset, kind of south of England.
This is of England. Okay, cool.
In what's called a hamlet.
Sure.
Which is basically a collection of like six houses and a postbox, nothing else.
Okay. In South Africa, there would be like one or two houses in a bottle store, like a liquor store.
No, yeah, but not even that. Like, I wish it was a liquor store, but it wasn't. It was just a postbox. You can buy nothing.
Lovely.
But yeah, so as a result of that, and also maybe because of my parents, I wasn't really allowed to watch TV or films as a child.
Oh, they kind of forbid it in a sense.
Yeah, I don't know if it was like forbidden or if it was just not something that we did. Like,
okay, you played outside.
We played outside a lot. It was like a lot of like mud pies.
Okay.
My dad specifically didn't like television unless it was stories about the war, but only then, as long as no animals died. And it was weird. So basically, my childhood really consisted of like watching Das Boot, because that was one of the only like legitimate things that we were allowed to watch.
Okay, so one of
I guess it was a submarine that was very safe for animals.
Yeah, a nice little, what was it, World War II submarine film?
Entirely in German, yeah.
In German, like, that's right. So that was one of your first sort of film memories.
Sure, if you can call it that. Yeah. You know, like people say to me, like, why did you get into acting? It really comes from the imagination space of me like wanting to pretend and play to be other people. There was certainly nothing about film that really inspired me when I was growing up because I didn't watch it.
Lovely.
But my puppy love, the first film I ever saw was at a friend's sleepover and I watched Titanic. And that, I can tell you, really blew my mind.
Because I would imagine.
Yeah, a lot of Das Boot. It was a very different kettle of fish, Titanic.
Oh, lovely. Okay, then over into high school, when you then started more formative school years, did you escape the hamlet to go to school or did you commute? How did it work?
Yes, I did escape the hamlet.
Okay.
So then I went to school. But at schools, I still don't really have very much. So basically then what happened, I then decided, I think around the age of 13, that I really, really wanted to go to Oxford. I don't know why.
Okay. To study at university.
Yeah, I wanted to study. That was my like life goal.
And
so from 13.
And you achieved it.
I did achieve it. Yeah. No, I at that stage, I was very determined. When I set my mind to something, it was going to get achieved.
Yeah.
But that basically meant from like my whole teenage years were really spent just again studying.
Okay.
I'm a real barrel of laughs.
Yeah.
So I remember even like when people were watching like TV at school and stuff, like I was like, guys, I got to get back to study. Like, I can't be messing with any of this, you know, moving images stuff.
What were you studying to, or what was your hope to study at Oxford? What did you want to do?
I wanted to do French and Spanish.
Okay.
Because those subjects were I found those subjects easiest. So
it wasn't necessarily about what you wanted to study. It was just about where. That was the focus.
Yeah. I just decided at 13 I wanted to go to Oxford and I was going to get there by any means possible. English, like if you study literature, very hard to get into.
I would imagine. Into Oxford. Yeah.
Same kind of history, both of them very competitive. But I figured French and Spanish was essentially a literature degree. So I was the same as doing English, but just in a different language. And also I fucking loved languages. Like,
yeah.
I really still to this day think that like, being able to speak a different language is kind of like a superpower. It's such a cool thing.
Totally.
So and I watched.
You pulled out a bit of French in Catch Me a Killer.
I did.
Which was nice. Yeah, yeah.
Because that's like the weird. There's weird stuff around like when I was reading her book and like researching Mickey, and obviously she's like very different to me. She's a South African woman, but there were so many weird like crossovers. Like she'd also done a BA in French. Just lots of like weird little bits where I was like, oh yeah, like me too. Even like,
lovely.
Remember like, early on in the scripts, there was like a scene with her sister where her sister was like, relax your jaw, Mickey. You've got loads of tension in your jaw. And I've always had loads of tension in my jaw.
Me
and
too.
When you read those. Yeah, really, really, really. I'm just like, I'm a real clencher and a grinder and all of my stress goes into my jaw. And I remember reading that and being like, huh. Okay, I guess, or like, you know, like the way, like her addiction with chocolate. I'm always like, I'm a real, both me and Mickey are real chocoholics. There were like just lots of little things where I was like,
yeah,
it kind of lots of little things that lined up. Anyway,
did your jaw get bad in high school when you were doing your fastidious studying for Oxford? Because I had a close to what we call our matric, I guess. I don't know whether that's your final year. Like my jaw like almost clicked out because it was because it was so tightly like done. My jaw has like kind of never been the same since. It was very sore.
Oh, wow.
No, because I was holding a lot of tension in my jaw. I've never been a very stressful person, but like around the exams, I remember me clenching my jaw.
No. Whenever I'm stressed, and you can see it in the shape of my face, like My jaw just gets a lot heavier when I'm like really stressed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like even on Catch Me a Killer, I remember like we were doing like so many like massaging every night, really, trying to be like relaxing my shit. But yeah, like that's just where I carry my stress weirdly.
And so anything in high school film wise or TV shows?
So film wise, I probably went down. I really tried to like watch French and Spanish because I was studying. You know, I had real focus. I knew where I was going.
Yeah.
But my favorite film around that time, I think, would be Tu Mama También.
Oh, lovely.
You know it's so good. And then you know what? I watched it again during lockdown. My boyfriend for COVID. My boyfriend and I were like, let's take this time seriously and watch films.
Yeah, I did the same thing.
And so I showed him this film and I was like, I have no memory of this film except that I love it. And I think that you will also love it. And we both watched it and we were like, wow.
Yeah, it was Alfonso Cuarón, right? Who went on to do like a Harry Potter movie. But this was...
The best Harry Potter.
He did the fourth
Harry Potter. Like the best Harry Potter movie there is.
He brought like a bit more sophistication to it, a bit more mature. Yeah. It was a bit darker. I remember that being the sort of the justification for him as opposed to Columbus, which is the happy sort of Spielbergian kind of magic. But Et Tu Mama Tambien, how do you pronounce it the best? For me also was such a great film at a particular time when you see like sex scenes done well, where you're like, it feels real, you know, and it's the awkwardness of those moments, you know, they're not this kind of pretty, you know, satin lace, you know, curtains. They can often be in these like awkward places. Like I think the one scene's like in a car. And you know, for like an adolescent male to like watch that, it was so great to like see those things done and done with such authenticity. And both those characters, both those actors, have gone on to be like famous actors.
Yeah. Diego Luna and Gael García Bernal. Yeah, they're both brilliant.
I love your I love your pronunciation of the tha. So funny.
It was really sexy without being gratuitous in any way.
That's the best way to describe it. It was still a sexy film.
But lovely.
Okay, that's a great high school film. Because that's kind of what you want from the high school crush film that we have. You want it to be a film that just exposes you to something a little more perhaps risque or a little more dangerous. Okay, but now let's get to Varsity Start of Career, because that's the next one, which is called It's Getting Serious. Because that's the kind of relationship you have where you're moving in, taking things a bit more seriously. Was there perhaps a film that came to you around the Oxford era?
So I'm trying to think if I must have started watching films around that time. It would make sense. But I was mostly doing theatre at that time, really.
Okay. Did you start acting in Oxford?
Yeah. So I started, I kind of always loved acting. Like I have like a really vivid memory of being like 6 or 7 and being in like an acting class and just thinking this is the most, like the purest high. Like this is such like electricity. I love this.
Okay.
But also just assuming that like, well, everyone must love this. And I didn't come from an acting family, or like I didn't know anyone that were actors. I didn't know that you could be an actor, except for like I see all these famous people, but I'm like, I don't know how you would achieve that. And I'd really made my mind up about going to Oxford. That was my path. And then when I got to Oxford, there was a lot of theatre. Like they had a really active like theatre department. So I was doing a lot of plays. And then I went to drama school in Paris. Oh, mime drama school. I went to physical theatre.
That's serious.
Yeah, really serious.
Because the French pride themselves on everything that they do. And one of those nuanced things in the world of acting is the French mime.
Exactly. Yeah. I took that very seriously.
Okay.
During that whole time, I was at Oxford, and I remember there was like a street casting of a casting director who was casting a French film called Serge Gainsbourg, Vie Héroïque, and they needed a young Jane Birkin. I don't think I look anything like Jane Birkin, but I think they were at the end of their search, and I had brown hair at that time. So.
Is this Birkin of the Birkin bag?
Exactly. Oh,
it is?
It's the same. She's really amazing. Okay. She'd done this song with Serge Gainsbourg called it's a really sexy song.
Okay.
Where she comes. You'd recognize it. I'm not gonna sing it.
Okay.
It'd be embarrassing. But I've been auditioning for this film, and then I kind of had the confidence to be like, oh, maybe I can do this for real. And so I got an agent off that, and then I started auditioning. But if I think about like what kind of films was I watching, I was kind of watching like I remember watching True Romance around that time.
Lovely.
Like,
yeah.
Again, like another just like, I guess very cool. I was really I was not cool at all when I was younger.
Okay. And this was really a chance to be cool.
Yeah. Like nice. Just to kind of like.
It's what you want from your varsity era, to sort of map out your version of cool.
Yeah, and I don't think I achieved it.
We never do. None of us do.
No. there was something that I guess was really drawn to that, like a year of, yeah.
Lovely. Okay, so was Oxford everything you wanted it to be? I mean, often when we spend so much time obsessing over these things, perhaps they don't live up to it. But was it everything you wanted it to be?
And it was complicated in a lot of ways. I think I had gone from being When I was younger, I was very, very determined, and I worked on the basis that, like, if you work really hard at something, you can achieve anything.
Yeah.
I got to Oxford, and I certainly wasn't the smartest person there by any length of the imagination. And suddenly it wasn't enough to just work really hard. You also had to have, like, a certain level of, like,
God-given
natural smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'm not dumb by any means. Yeah. I'm smart. I'm not like super, super smart. So I was never able to really compete at the level that I would have wanted to.
Okay.
But on top of that, at Oxford, you kind of have to pick one thing and like,
yeah.
I think this is true of most university. Like,
yeah.
I wanted to study, but I also wanted to do loads of plays and I wanted to like have a good time.
Okay.
And I think you can maybe do two, but you really only can do one, and it really should be studying. So my first 2 years, I was really trying to do all three.
Okay. No, but
the detriment of,
yeah, you were doing
but interestingly, in my last year, because I had this year abroad to go and be a French mime, when I came back in my last year, I was like, I didn't do any plays. I had an agent by that stage, and I rang my agent and I was like, don't call me for 9 months, I'm doing my finals.
Yeah.
And all my friends had left because they'd been doing 3-year courses. So I had no friends, I had no plays, and I just had study. And I will tell you, it was probably the happiest year of my life.
Oh, interesting.
No, not my life, certainly. Not my life. But it was okay. So satisfying, because like for the first time, it was just me and the books, and I just like studied for a year, and it was the only time in Oxford that I felt really fulfilled because I was actually like doing the work properly.
The last film we have is the film you would settle down with, which is, I'm curious to see whether that's come your way. The film you could marry. Do you have any idea what that might be?
I don't. You'll notice I haven't prepared my answers.
No, it's totally fine.
This is really coming off the top of my head.
This is just to guide the conversation. It's not a definitive thing. Don't worry.
Okay, good. Because they sent me a thing being like, they were going to ask you about your films, and I thought, I must sit down and think about my films, and then I did not remember to do that.
No stress.
So I'm going to name a film which I actually only watched a few weeks ago.
Cool.
Because I watched my parents, and I was down at my parents for the weekend, and we just had this really gorgeous weekend, the three of us.
Yeah.
And we watched this film that was like the most lovely, it was like a warm hug of a film.
Lovely.
It's called Saving Grace.
Saving Grace. It's a film. Okay.
Yeah, it's a film about Brenda Blethyn, who is one of our like national treasures.
Okay.
Absolutely heaven. It's like in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay.
And she's this kind of like posh English woman living in this tiny town in Cornwall. And her husband has died. And it turns out that she's got loads and loads of debts.
Okay.
And she's like, what shall I do to fix all of my woes? And her gardener smokes weed. And so they decide to turn. And she's also an incredible gardener, but she's got no other skills, so no other way she could make any money.
Okay.
And so they both set up this like weed farm on in the house in Port Isaacs, which is Cornwall. And it's like,
this is ringing bells. I remember this.
It's so lovely. Like, I had never had seen
a heartwarming drug dealer.
Exactly. It was like, I was just with my parents. I was like, it's really just a gorgeous film.
Just
makes you smile. Like, I was smiling the whole way through.
Being a bit naughty. Yeah. And the sort of the joy of that. Have you seen The Gentleman, Guy Ritchie's Netflix film?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's also about the sort of weed farm on the, you know, underneath.
Yeah, but this one's like,
this is completely different.
Like gangsters and gnarly. And this, you know, it's got a gangster in it, but it's just, it's like, it's really, because you also like the whole town gets high, and it's just like,
Yeah.
It's just gorgeous and feel good.
Like, we like that. We like a good one of those. Okay, saving grace. With the remaining sort of minute or two left, I just wanted to ask you quickly what your Game of Thrones experience was like, because I think that that's such a lovely thing to have been a part of. Where were you shooting those scenes?
So I shot everything of that in Belfast.
Okay.
I had a magical, let me talk about it because we have time, because it really was, it's like such a special place in my heart, because Game of Thrones came about at a time when like I really had this sense that like everyone was on these like fun adventures, everyone like doing acting jobs was like going on these fun adventures, and I was feeling really left behind because like the first, I think like 5 years of my career were like a struggle. Like it was and when I got Game of Thrones, I remember I'd been auditioning for like this other job that I got really close to and I didn't get, and I was really upset, and my agent rang me and was like, you have this, it's a one scene role on Game of Thrones, and he was like, I don't think you should do it because it's got loads of nudity. And I was like, no, I want to do it, I haven't got any work, I need to work, I And he was like, all
right,
Shauna.
That was a very convincing cry, by the way. Carry on. Yeah, yeah.
So I went and did the job, and it was just a day, and I had, like, the best time. Like, that crew, there's something about, like, everyone going to work loves going to work because they all know that they're making something, like...
So it was quite established at that point. What season did you show up in?
Season 3 I showed up in.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I just like did this day, and I just thought, wow, that was like the best experience ever. I loved it.
Mm.
And then they ended up bringing me back for more.
Mm.
So, and actually they didn't really give me my meaty stuff until season 5, which meant that for me as an actress, by the time I got to season 5, I wasn't scared. Like,
oh, lovely. It wasn't this intimidating, you know, first day on set. Yeah.
I think if I'd had that from the get-go, I would have been like a bit like overwhelmed or stressed. But by the time I got to season 5, I like knew everyone. And it really was like, it was everything I hoped it would be. Like, okay. I have this real memory of like being in the car on the way home. I've done this like week of like quite intense filming, and just having that like feeling of being so satisfied and so like, I finally got to do the thing that I always wanted to do, and it was everything that I hoped it would be, and all. I'm so glad that happened.
Oh, that's lovely.
It really was. It was just a magical, magical job, and like, and just everyone.
The fact that you get to have been a part of that, because I think it'll probably go down as being one of sort of the last sort of big TV shows. Because I think we're so split up.
Yeah.
We're so split up these days, you know, where everything's on different streaming platforms, and so we all tuned in. But listen, I think I'm getting a little reminder here in the corner that we've got less than a minute. So I would hate to have my goodbyes be cut short. I just wanted to say well done on Catch Me a Killer. I really think it's great. It would be lovely to see you return. And if you ever do find yourself in this tip of Africa, it would be lovely to have you come and visit us here at the cinema.
Oh, no, I would love that. And with Donna, wonderful Donna, who I completely adore, who played Erica in the show, who is now one of my bestest friends. So I'm always trying to find like
a reason.
Chances for things to, a reason to hang out.
Where is she based?
In Cape Town.
Okay. Cape Town's lovely, but there's a good chance that you'll probably have to pass through Joburg. And and so when that happens, it would be lovely to have you come and see the Bioscope, which is great.
No, I would love to.
No, lovely, man. And all the best for everything, man. It was lovely chatting, and thank you for making the time.
Thank you. That was really fun.
And yeah. We'll hopefully see you soon.
Okay. I'll cross my fingers. But thank you so much. This was, it was really fun.
Cool. Cheers, eh? Bye. Awesome.
Thanks so much. Bye.
All right. What a great chat. And what a great opportunity to have such a such an interesting chat with such an interesting person. And we, I really wish we had a bit more time because we were just getting started on Game of Thrones. And of course, that could be a whole discussion on its own.
Yeah,
exactly.
But it was just lovely to meet someone who was a part of it. And I think for her, it was lovely to have just been a part of something like that. Just
exactly.
Just to have played us, even if it was a slightly smaller role. But yeah, it was quite intense. She died in a crazy way, hey? Do we remember?
It was also a while ago, but I'm pretty sure she got like nailed to the bed with arrows or something. It was either
Ramsay Bolton
or Joffrey that did something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
I remember it was like a side character, like little moment where you're like, oh, there's that person that's now dead.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah. No. We must rewatch it. It feels like such a lifetime ago.
I don't know if I'd ever rewatch it.
Yeah, that's actually a good point.
Yeah.
Hey, most of that show is pretty good.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But it's like the new Star Wars trilogy, right? Yeah. You kind of get into the space of being so excited about it over a period of 4 years from 7 to 8. And then 9 comes and I forget the entire thing existed.
Yeah.
Like I haven't gone back to that trilogy now since episode 9 released.
Yeah.
It destroyed it for me. So same with Game of Thrones. But on the topic of Game of Thrones, if you're keen to move on.
Yes.
I was very skeptical about ever going back to any content made by D&D because I was so angry with them about season 8.
Now, explain D&D
quickly.
Yeah,
what does that mean?
D.B. Weiss and David Benioff are the creators of Game of Thrones.
Well, so they're the showrunners of Game of Thrones.
The creators of Game of Thrones.
Get out of here, George.
A sensationalist trailer voice. Yeah. But totally, like the guys who did the show, right? Adapted the George R.R. Martin books.
Yeah.
And did a fantastic job with it, I think, overall, right? Yeah. So
sure, it was arguably, as we said with Charlotte, arguably one of the
greatest shows ever
TV
made.
Shows.
Totally. And they obviously were the hottest shit in town, so they signed a multi-million dollar deal with Netflix after Game of Thrones, right?
Okay.
And the first series that they've been working on since Game of Thrones that came out this year is Three Body Problem.
Which is a strange name.
Yes.
Right?
It's an off-putting name.
I was about to say, that's the reason I haven't like gotten into this at all. I was like, that's a weird name.
See, like if you don't know that it's a scientific, like a paradox, like a concept.
But the scientific concept is called like the something, there's another word. It's like the something body problem. So I don't know where the three comes in.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I think.
So like what they explain in the series, and it might be giving away the plot a little bit, is that the three body problem is a problem with classical and quantum physics and maths and science, right?
Okay.
And it's that if you have three bodies in space, like stars, that each affects each other through gravity because of their mass.
Okay.
It results in like a problem that you can't predict. You can't predict the outcome of it, basically.
Okay.
So if a planet were to exist in the solar system,
having the third element in. Okay, so maybe
You can project the trajectory of a planet around two stars, apparently.
Yes.
Or like that kind of thing. But if a third body is thrown into that group, then it becomes random forever.
So it's the definition of body in that thing.
Exactly.
That's okay.
When I first saw it, I was like human bodies?
Yes,
like my
exactly.
Body?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, why would that be a problem?
Like
it sounds like
body.
A fun time.
Yeah. Okay, but this is also based on a book.
Yes.
Based on a famous science fiction book.
Yes.
That they are now adapting.
Yeah, it's a Chinese author named Liu Cixin.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Xi.
Yeah.
X is a Xi.
Yeah, yeah. It's like President Xi.
Xi Jinping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it won the Hugo Award, like Dune. Right?
Yeah, which is a famous science fiction book award.
So they plan to apparently adapt this into 4 seasons.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Assuming the first and second season do well.
Yes.
Given that it's Netflix.
No. Apparently it's like dominated in its second week.
Right.
Not in its first. Because everyone was probably like, what the fuck? Three bodies?
It is a little slow start. I did try.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is it doesn't hook you 100%. But basically you get the sense that there's a group of friends who are scientists.
And they're called the Oxford Five.
Okay. Do we know why they called that?
because they were all trained by a certain physicist that you see at the start of the episode.
Oh,
at the particle accelerator.
Okay. And you get the sense that in the scientific community, they're starting to pick up the fact that something strange is happening.
Yes.
These particle accelerator testing sites around the world are producing strange data that they can't explain. And then relatively quickly, and I think you get this from the trailer, one or two people are sort of seeing this countdown that's sort of in, it's coming into their vision.
Yes.
And so they kind of, it's making them crazy that they're seeing this sort of fiery spark letter, like numbers, and it's counting down, and it's sort of driving them insane because they can't sort of see past this.
Yes.
This vision.
All right.
And a series of physicists and scientists around the world are killing themselves for reasons we don't explain.
Yeah.
Or don't know.
Yeah.
And a detective played by Benedict Wong, who plays Wong.
Ooh, in the Doctor's. Love Benedict Wong.
Yes. But this isn't just any Benedict Wong. This is him with like a cool like English accent.
Being a he is
English. He has an English accent.
Really? Normally?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. And he's playing a hard-as-nails detective that's cool. Smoking all the time, trying to find out the truth. And he's skeptical, and he's got a problematic son that he can't figure out. It is awesome. And his boss, is Liam Cunningham, who played Sir Davos Seaworth.
I was going to ask, when you said, speaking of Game of Thrones and went into this, I was going to say, what's the connection?
Yes.
Other than,
So same D&D. Showrunners.
Same showrunners,
bringing back a whole bunch of casts,
and one or two of the Game of Thrones people are in Three Body Problem now as well.
Oh, Jonathan Pryce is in it as well.
Jonathan Pryce is in it.
He's also
Jonathan
in Game Pryce. Of Thrones.
He was the weird Meister in Game of Thrones that was like the
priest dude,
heretic priest.
Yes,
that converted. Yeah, yeah.
The shame.
Yeah,
guy.
The shame guy.
Yeah, and yeah. But also the chubby, lovable guy.
Yeah, Samwell.
The
Samwell.
Okay.
Was his name, apparently, Graham told me earlier. Yes.
Not Samwise.
Samwell.
You don't need to bring that into the podcast.
In Game of Thrones, his name was Samwell.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, that's right. Wild.
And he is fantastic. Dude, the acting across this entire series is incredible.
Where are you in it now?
I finished it.
You finished what's available? Season one.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is how many episodes?
8.
Okay.
I think
it's manageable.
Yeah, and they're all like a good hour long. So, so it's an 8-hour endeavor.
It escalates pretty well.
On Netflix?
Mm.
Yeah, okay. It escalates?
It escalates incredibly well.
Cool. Okay.
It's like, I like the fact that I didn't know what it was about going in, so I don't want to give away the... What's the idiom there, guys? You give away the ghost. I heard my boss say this the other day. I don't want to give away the ghost yet.
Right.
That's an interesting one. I'm going to remember that.
Cool.
Because it's a cool discovery as you go along. But if you're a person that loves science problems and figuring out cool theories about space,
Okay. This
is a cool show to watch. But it's also an incredible thriller. And surprisingly, it becomes really gory.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, I did not see that coming. Yeah,
okay.
I was like cover my eyes moments.
Okay, I'm at the point where the helmets come into play now.
Ooh.
And then it gets weird.
Okay.
It's like it's
in
weird
a good way.
Yeah, well, it's weird enough to sort of have this hallucination that they're perhaps somehow being communicated to.
Right.
There's a lot of kind of simple stuff, but it's unknown. But the moment that helmet arrives, it then gets a bit weird.
Okay interesting. I saw it as another question.
Right. Okay.
What is this? Who's it from?
Okay.
What does it do?
Sure. Okay.
And it made me cry,
which
hasn't happened in a while.
Okay, so it can get a little heartstringy.
Yeah.
Play on them heartstrings.
It's very good the way it like deals with a certain like concepts and death. I won't get around it, but
right. It's
stunning. I think it works really well. It's got a human element. There's enough mystery. I'm impressed. D&D, I will forgive you.
Yeah. Well, just speaking of impressed... That's probably a really good way to just describe Catch Me a Killer.
Right.
Okay.
The TV show on Showmax that Charlotte's in. Like, you know, I watched it because I have the opportunity to now talk to her.
Mm.
But really upon getting into it, I was like, fuck, I'm so impressed by how well this show is made.
Mm.
It's a really, really well made show. It's cool. Super slick. She's an incredible actress.
Hell
and yeah. And it's just it's it was just done so well. Like, just every part of the set design and the production and every part of it was great.
In the chat with her, did you mention that it's the South African Mindhunter?
I don't know whether I can't remember if I spoke specifically about it, but yeah, because I think we all sort of know it's that. You know, because right. all of that was, you know, it's so funny. It's one of those things where all of that was happening in police stations around the world at a certain time when the idea of detectiving evolved to this point where psychology was now coming into it.
Right.
You know, where it was no longer something that just clues could solve, especially when you're dealing with this point where you've got these like weird killers doing things for weird reasons. So you kind of have to start understanding society at that point. You have to start understanding what's going on in someone's head to understand them better. Yeah. It's interesting when you start feeling that evolution.
I'm excited to get into
it. That probably was a testament to sort of society changing at a certain point.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, like certain definitive things like world wars or depressions or, you know, the advent of television, that could change the mental state of people, you know, or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's like we underestimate just how much political shifts influence our narratives in popular media. I mean, if you think of 9/11, like post 9/11 is a genre of film, like that we get into, right? It's how you get into all the films that deal with like a focus on the Middle East and terrorism and psyops and I don't know. You know, it's like
even less literally than that. Like Cloverfield is very much a post 9/11 movie.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
yeah, it's like the other invading New York. Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. But talking about eras, this might be a bit of a tangent.
Okay,
I've discovered something crazy, which I didn't like know was a thing in the slightest. So we went to go watch all of us,
except for me.
You didn't go to the premiere, did you?
No, I was away. I was in Cape Town.
Oh.
The Godzilla.
Yeah, Godzilla. You were here on the weekend last week.
What's that?
Were you here on the weekend or were you in Cape Town?
I was in Cape Town. Yeah. I couldn't make the Godzilla thing.
Oh, so you couldn't make when Graham and I went to watch it together either. So that's why I didn't invite you, because I knew. So yeah, we went to go watch Godzilla X Kong. So no, it's not longer Godzilla versus Kong.
Yes.
What's the new empire?
Yeah, there you go.
Yes. I should know that. But fantastic Godzilla movie.
It's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun. It is a fun as hell movie.
I think it's more of a King Kong movie than a Godzilla movie.
Yeah. Like he's the character.
Yeah. It's interesting that this time they, like King Kong was our point of view character.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't the people.
Which is cool.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I kind of like that about it. Mm. It wasn't like trying to shoehorn in this really emotional Millie Bobby Brown narrative. You know, it was more just Kong.
Yeah.
Going through the motions of whatever problem he has.
Yes.
Okay. Which is now being in the hollow earth.
Yeah, I was about to say, there's something to do with like the center of the earth.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. Even if you'd invited me, I'm not entirely sure whether I would have gone.
Don't you like movies about giant monsters beating each other up like Pacific Rim?
I get the idea. I get the appeal. I would have gone to have seen it on IMAX.
Right.
Yeah.
No, exactly.
But I mean, I know that you guys have consumed a lot of the Godzilla movies and you're there for it all. So.
Yeah.
Here for it, dude.
Yeah.
So 60% of this movie is monsters beating each other up, which is why it gets 4 stars from me. There was a moment where Godzilla picked up, was it Kong?
Yeah.
And did one of those WWE wrestling moves where you throw them over your back and both land on your back on the floor.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, fuck, it's now WWE wrestling moves from Godzilla.
Yeah.
It was awesome. You're like, yeah, yeah. But lots of fun. And the big shift, like the big shift in this one is that Godzilla gets pink atomic breath.
Yes.
And pink spines when he charges up the... it's now pink and not blue.
Okay.
So I went in there thinking, is it going to be a they, them, she Godzilla that pitches up? And I was going to be annoyed if it was.
So boy Godzilla is blue and girl Godzilla is pink.
I was so worried that something like that was happening, but... It wasn't. It was just Godzilla becoming more powerful by getting a different kind of nuclear source.
And more proud of their own identity and confidence in their own identity.
Totally. I'm so happy to see Godzilla adopting their queerness. But actually, it's a reference to stuff that's happened in the previous Godzilla Japanese movies.
Right.
Okay.
And discovered that there are different periods that fans define the Godzilla movies, talking about periods in film,
yeah,
based on when emperors in Japan reigned.
Right.
Okay. So,
are there still emperors in Japan?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's still like a royal family. I don't Japan know if they
have... Japan has a prime minister, so I guess that makes sense.
Yes.
That a country would have a prime minister if they have a monarchy that still has some control.
Yes. I don't know if it's like similar to the UK monarchy in the way that it acts with or...
Probably not.
...on parliaments. No.
But I would, that makes sense that the Japanese haven't given up some sense of emperors, because that seems to be an important part of them.
No, like, okay. Totally. Part of their identity.
Oh, okay, so I think it's also worth mentioning that the Godzilla films are quite special in the fact that there are just so many of them.
Yeah.
It's one of the biggest film franchises in history, I think, based on just how many. We're talking like...
50 movies?
50 odd proper big... You know, releases. Okay, so they are?
So, the first era is the Showa era with Emperor Showa.
Okay.
Okay, and that guy reigned from 1926 to 1989. And then the Heisei era is 1989 to 2019, is Emperor Akihito.
Okay.
Right? So I think we've all heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2019, he stepped down as emperor. I can't remember, but I remember it being, it's like, whoa, an emperor stepped down. And then his son... became the new emperor, Naruhito.
Okay.
And now we're in the Reiwa era of Godzilla.
Okay.
Okay, right? And that's Shin Godzilla, that's Godzilla minus one.
Yeah.
That's the era that we're in right now.
Okay.
So, and then you get the Monsterverse era and the Millennium era. Okay. So I think like Zilla of Roland Emmerich's Godzilla movie would be in the Millennium era.
Okay.
Like, I think that's how it like counts. Because it's also,
I don't
like,
think they count that Godzilla at all.
Oh, no. I don't think Westerners count that Godzilla at all. But the idea that the color of the breath changed to a different color to show a level up is something that happened in the Heisei era.
Right.
And then in the Millennium era of Godzilla is also when his color changed pink, because he became more powerful. Right. So it's something that's happened before.
Okay, but it's a nice reference that the Western Hollywood Godzillas are honoring the more traditional Asian Godzillas.
Absolutely.
Right.
Okay. Speaking of crazy violence and cool wrestling moves.
Yeah.
Monkey Man.
Oh shit! You watched Monkey Man?
Can we talk about Monkey Man?
Dude, yeah, totally.
Are you cool with Godzilla now?
Yeah, I'm done with Godzilla, dude. I'll never be done with Godzilla, but we can stop talking about him. They, them.
Monkey Man is now in cinemas, one of those cinemas being the Bioscope.
Woo!
Nice.
I just spotted it a while away. I think it took Graham sharing the trailer when we first saw it months ago to go, oh my God, look how crazy this movie is. Just, it looks special, and it is special. It's different. It's a action film, so kind of similar to the ones we know, like a sort of John Wick, getting vengeance. But it's set in India, and you can see that there's just a extra layer of heart and difference to it. So we're all very intrigued to watch it. So we watched the special screening of it last week. As of last Friday, it's now been in cinemas. It is the directorial debut of Dev Patel.
Yeah.
That is so cool. It's so cool when an actor that you don't expect becomes a director, but someone that's so lovable as a star.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and just someone who's always done sort of that much more meaningful work. So we know him from Slumdog Millionaire. That was his breakout.
Yeah.
A film like Lion is just incredible.
You love Lion.
Me?
Yeah.
I fucking love Lion. No, I still haven't watched this. Yeah. Oh my God. What a big happy cry.
I know, happy cries are the worst.
Kudu.
I know.
There's a scene where like a little him has lost his brother in the train station.
A little him.
Yeah.
And so this tiny little boy is in like the wrong train station because he overslept and he missed his mark, and then he loses his brother. This is the movie Lion.
No.
And they're in like Calcutta, and he's like looking for his brother, and his brother's called Gudu. And this little boy's going, Gudu. it's crazy, and it's based on a true story.
Yeah.
But Monkey Man is now his directorial debut, and the character itself puts every inch of blood, sweat, and tears into his vengeance, which is to go after these wealthy dudes, part of this politician on the cusp of this election, but these people were involved in the killing of his parents, his family, his mom specifically.
Okay.
And he finds himself going after them, using his ability his fists to go for it. And so it's this great vengeance film. And you think it might be something a bit bigger, but it's actually really just this very personal vendetta, this personal vengeance to topple the evil in his world. And but he, as the director, the writer and director, was putting every inch of blood, sweat, and tears into his movie. And so, like, that feeds into his character, in a sense. That, like, that's what makes his performance better.
Right.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Because it's him himself that's also making this movie. So you can imagine that motivated him even more in these moments when he's getting the shit beaten out of him, where literally just sweat, blood. But it's really great. I liked it.
What would be the reason that you would motivate people to watch it, considering that we've seen like 100 vengeance action movies?
I think its setting in India makes it different.
Right.
I think his heart and intention behind the film itself makes it different.
Okay.
It is very much in line with the others.
Cool.
So it isn't wildly different. I'm not going to pretend that it's not, you know, an action film we do know.
Right.
But I just think that intention and that purpose and that fucking heart.
Yes. Sure.
You know, because we also know him as that kind of actor who just brings so much. He's very revealing in his face.
Yes.
You know, where the Stathams of the world are very stoic and very, like, you know, they're unbreakable, right? Yeah.
There are
despite
a few
being like older,
actors,
bald men.
Yeah. There are a few actors in the world who understand the power of acting with your eyes.
Yeah, and even like
he knows that you look into his eyes and it's just
and like
there's so much going on.
Keanu Reeves has never really had much going on, and that's been part of what's often made it work for him.
Yeah,
where there's just so much more pure, and just like, for example, there's this one training montage where like he's in this temple and this dude's playing the a traditional Indian drum, and he's punching to this. Indian drumming rhythm.
Oh, cool.
You know, which we, we kind of know this trope, especially in the Asian films where it's like, you know, the wax on, wax off. Like, use your Asianness to inspire your fighting style or the rhythm of what you're going to do, right?
Yeah.
But it was cool to see an Indian version, and it was cool to just have this so confidently sit amongst all the others and sit there proudly as like just another great action film, but something authentically different that was just a different flavor.
Right.
So just that alone is enough. The uniqueness of its Indian flavor.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I suppose there is value to it just being a culturally specific movie, right? Mm. Like, we don't get to see it in that context very often, but revenge movies in America, it's kind of like,
yeah,
that's flogging a dead horse.
Yeah, you know? No, and the inequality, especially in India, and the class system of India, is hectic. And so it's quite cool to sort of see a hero rise out of that, try and topple that system, which is just so firmly ingrained in Indian culture.
Mm.
It's hectic, yeah.
Right.
On a lighter note.
Oh, lovely.
Is it Cake 3?
Oh, no.
I've got a sickie fiancé at the moment, so we weren't watching anything too challenging.
Right.
And Is it Cake 3, the new season of Is It Cake, which is the ridiculous Netflix TV show where master cake bakers have to deceive judges by making realistic-looking cakes that look like other objects.
Right.
So there's all different themes, but for example, you know, like a hamburger, for example, they would make a cake that looks so realistically like a hamburger. It's then up to a set of judges to see that cake in amongst others to pick which one is cake and which one isn't cake.
Right.
It's a preposterous show, and there's moments where when you're watching it, you even yourself goes like, this is so dumb.
But like, why am I watching this?
No, but like that comes to you sort of every sort of 10, 20 minutes where you're like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But then immediately you're like, but it's great. Do you know what I mean? Because it's fun. And I just thought, what's really interesting about the show is that you've got 15, or it starts with like maybe 10 bakers, And they're all very supportive of each other, which you do see in some reality shows, you know, where they band together and they enjoy each other's company and they encourage each other. But what I think is quite specifically interesting about this show is that, yes, they are competing against each other in the fact that there will be a winner and a loser. But when it actually comes to the judging, they're not competing against each other. They're only competing against themselves,
right?
Which is quite an interesting structure. So when it comes time, let's just say the three of us are in a round, I have to do water bottles, or and you're going to do laptops, you know, where your cake is a cake laptop.
My goodness.
When it comes time to judging, it's really only your cake against decoys.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So it's not like you and me. You and me are never directly competing. Where it's like blown away, the glass blowing competition, their things are up against each other in a theme, and then they pick a winner and they pick a loser.
Right. That's interesting, because how do you make it competitive and compelling? Because the entire thing with those shows is often the drama between the contestants. That's fun to watch.
Yeah, so this is so participatory, because you don't know it. It's often, unless you were paying very careful attention to the specific cake that that person was baking, when it comes time to the judging, you're like, I actually don't know which one is cake.
I know.
And they are so fucking good as cakes, like, it is really difficult.
Right. Remember how Graham complained that you can't make this concept into like an entire episode? It should be a TikTok video.
Yes.
Should be like a minute long. Now there's three seasons of it, Graham.
Right.
Yeah. There's three seasons of like how many episodes per season?
Yeah, no. It's a full-on thing. But it's great.
I'm going to give it a go, Russ.
No, it's just, you know, especially when you've got like a sicky person on the couch, you really can't get into, you know, the philosophy and scientific, you know, debate of three-body problem. Yeah. You just kind of want to know, like, is it cake?
Oh, right.
It or seems like not cake. One of those, what's the term that's been used a lot lately? Like second screen
show? It's a
show,
second screen show.
Which, by the way, I hate that.
Disgusting. No, I know.
It is hate so that, gross. But it seems like that sort of show.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Something that I actually did watch over the weekend, which was really great, and I think it's a cool thing to talk about, which was a little more serious. It wasn't so much as a second screen film, is the Netflix film Scoop, which is new, and it is about the real-life story of the journalists at the BBC who managed to get the Prince Andrew interview.
Oh, damn.
The exclusive Prince Andrew interview at the height of his links to Epstein.
Yes.
That disastrous interview.
Yeah, well, it was all about them setting that interview up.
Right.
And I just, you know, we were talking earlier about society and how that influences our filmmaking and our storytelling, and I just think we're at such a great point now where we're using films and series and content world to tell the real life, the crazy real life stories.
Yes,
you know, I think there's something so cool to about the sort of more bio series, biopic series, especially about all the creators. You know, there's one about the people who started Uber. There's one about the Spotify people. There's one about, you know, that it's like, it's definitely a trend to tell these stories. And this is a smaller story, but it's the one that you don't think about, because you often don't think about the journalists and what it means to have put this kind of thing together.
Absolutely.
Especially when you're the British and you're dealing with the monarchy. So,
It's so interesting you mentioned that. Sorry. I watched The Crown. Oh, I'm busy watching The Crown. I've got two episodes to go.
Yeah, which is the same.
Exactly.
You know,
and when
field
they,
of
there's
discussion.
Like four episodes around trying to get the Princess Di interview to the BBC after she's divorced Charles.
Yes.
You know, and like what a mission it is.
Yeah.
And like what an achievement it is to actually get that. So with this, I can't imagine. And I see that Rufus Sewell plays
Sewell
Prince
or whatever.
Andrew.
Yeah, and you don't think he could pull it off, but they make him look so much like
really?
Prince Andrew, yo.
I was about to say, because he just, I hate to say this, but he's always been a bad guy.
He's always a bad guy, yeah.
It's because of his face. The bad guy from A Knight's Tale.
Yes.
Guy from A Knight's Tale.
Yes.
He was the object of, who's Bridget Jones? What's her name? In Love Actually, he was the one that she was fascinated, that was obsessed with, who didn't give her love. You know, in that line of Love Actually.
Yes.
But you'll recognize him instantly. He's got those really sort of piercing eyes.
Yeah.
But he transforms really well. So Prince Andrew, for those who don't remember or know, is Prince Charles's brother.
Yeah.
So the Queen's sons. So this is the
Prince
guy.
Prince Charles?
Yeah.
King Charles.
Yeah, King Charles now. Sorry. Yeah. So this is the other brother who wasn't in line to the throne. The lesser sort of spoken about son of the Queen, who, you know, had a big fat relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, who, if you were remotely close to the guy, you were dirty because he was just so prolific for so long, you know, doing all sorts of financial deals, which were probably all suspect, but perhaps relatively on board. But you hung out with him because he procured women, mostly very young women.
Yeah.
And everyone had a, you know, a fat party on islands and private planes and mansions in New York, where there was just this rotating door of women that were brought in, mostly handled by the girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell, who's the daughter of this disgraced media tycoon. But Prince Andrew was friends with Ghislaine. So it's like, he's not a good dude.
Yeah.
He can't be. He can't be he the can't nicest be a good guy. He just literally can't be.
Yeah.
And this is about the journalists who, when that was breaking, were able to convince him and his people that an interview needed to happen because he was never going to get around this. It had to be addressed. And so rather let it be with us. And they got this exclusive interview with him, which led to him stepping away from royal duties.
Yeah.
So even if it was just that they could achieve, you just see this like just the point of being a journalist,
right?
And what it meant, and just for you as the audience member to realize just the extent of what goes into these things that you just think are, you know, everyday occurrences like these interviews, but they take an incredible amount of planning and preparation.
It's like watching the spotlight, right?
Yeah, it's similar. Because also to realize how these things play out.
Mm.
Sometimes it is time and meetings. And
so, and yeah, also, so these kinds of stories are really important. It's like we need to make sure that journalists have the power and the funding, at least good journalists, to be able to discover this stuff, right? We need to support good journalism.
And also just to let... What I find interesting is that they didn't get... It wasn't the interview wasn't so scandalous that they got him to say certain things, but just by the way they phrased the questions and just by the way he answered, you could get so much from it. It was revealing so much, which I think is great. So this is Scoop,
and it's got Gillian Anderson.
Gillian Anderson is the woman who conducts the interview.
Oh, okay,
she's great. She does a great job in this.
Oh, I love Gillian.
So yeah, so Scoop. It's on Netflix. It's a smarter show with a smarter watch. It's a film. And definitely worth your time for something a bit more serious.
Cool.
Great. That's fantastic.
But speaking of journalists, Civil War is coming to cinemas.
Oh, right.
In the week that this episode's coming out. It's starting on Friday. The Bioscope's going to screen it. This is an A24 film.
Yeah.
So something a bit more serious, a bit more focused and intense. This is Alex Garland, who he wrote The Beach, but then he also...
He wrote the book, right?
He wrote the book, The Beach. But
and
then,
Sunshine.
And Sunshine.
Mm-hmm. The book.
Well, no, the movie.
Oh, you wrote the movie Sunshine, as well. Yeah. Okay.
Ex Machina, which is a great film. And so Civil War is about like America breaking out into civil war now.
Mm.
That's so hectic, man.
And he's it's sort of hopefully not too prophetic, but, you know, going on this idea of how societies can be so polarized, obviously, especially the states. You've got the Florida Alliance and you've got the Western forces. And this film is about a team of journalists that are making their way to D.C.
Yes.
But there's planes flying over. There's bombs going off. There's like, it looks
apparently
very interesting.
Rough. And this is his last movie.
Well, he said that, he's not going to do a movie for any sort of time soon.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is real interesting. But
yeah.
I don't know whether it's interesting. I don't know whether that was necessary to say, but
yes. No, but it's interesting. He's always made great movies. If you've seen Annihilation on Netflix.
Yeah, that was also
like a cool movie, just trying out different things, right? With that freaking bear. haunts everyone's nightmares.
Yeah.
And also Men, which I haven't watched.
I haven't seen Men.
Yeah, it looked weird as hell.
Yeah.
But creepy.
But yeah, Civil War, man.
But Civil War, can you imagine, dude?
I just think America. It's going to be so interesting. It's such an interesting document for history.
Yes, like what we see might happen in America if that had to happen. Because it's on everyone's minds in a way. Like we can see how we're all more politically divided. We can see how extreme some sides of American politics are becoming socially.
Mm.
And it's distressing.
Yeah.
But then again, we have the pair of, I see in the trailer, the pair of Jesse Plemons and Kirsten Dunst.
Yeah.
Like Kirsten a happy Dunst couple. Is
the, yeah.
Are there a couple in real life?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because I think that, yeah, she's the journalist and he's one of the bad dudes.
Yeah. I just saw he was a soldier.
Yeah. And there's this great line where they say, no, don't kill us. We're Americans. Yeah. And he's like, which Americans?
Yeah.
Which is like this big sort of. Yeah. And so don't dismiss it. I think that's the most important thing I want to get across is like, don't dismiss it as like a silly action. I think it's going to be, I know it's so much smarter.
If Alex Garland's behind it, there's a statement there.
Yeah.
And of so some kind.
It should hopefully be a good Bioscope film.
Cool.
Yeah, I think it will be.
Just for the kind of people that are just that much smarter, that much more.
I'm smart. I can watch it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've always been a big fan of Alex Garland. So I would see it just in the merits of him making it.
Yeah.
Cool.
100%.
Yeah. I think that's everything from my side, guys.
Didn't you watch something more cheerful this week?
Yes, well, debatably. Okay, I'm going to start this with an anecdote. So in the evenings, Cole and I have been playing Destiny a lot lately.
Yes.
And we log on last night to play. In the, 20-minute gap between me ending this movie and us starting to play,
yes,
I'd completely forgotten about the fact that I'd watched it. Because I was like, I'm going to have a good time bitching to Cole about this one.
Yeah.
And then I forgot that I'd watched Wish.
Yeah, you didn't mention it.
Yeah, because I forgot.
Wait, so sorry.
Because it's forgettable.
While you were playing the game,
yes,
you were talking about the movie.
No. I didn't because I completely forgot that I'd watched it.
Okay.
20 minutes before we started playing.
That is nuts.
Because it's that forgettable.
Okay. No ways.
So this is Wish, one of Disney's several flops from last year.
Yeah.
They had a bad year. And it's just so forgettable. It's not even like a dreadful film.
Right.
It's just nothing.
Okay.
Nothing movie.
As if like an AI wrote it.
Not even that. It's just like the characters are, none of them are memorable. None of them have character arcs.
This was the
film. The world doesn't make any sense.
Yes. This was the movie that everyone on TikTok was complaining about, comparing the villain dad's villain song.
Yeah.
Like if you think Mother Knows Best from Tangled.
Yeah.
Mother Knows Best. Take it from your dun-dun. Like queers love that song. Okay. Because there's a sinister nature to it. There's but then the dad song is like, I pay rent and you don't even pay rent.
Well, he's the king. He's not the dad.
Yeah, the king.
Yes.
But everyone was comparing this villain song to Frollo's song from Hunchback of Notre Dame.
That's a bad comparison because Hellfire, that song, is a complete outlier in Disney's catalog of songs.
No,
there are no other songs like that one. But to be fair, the song isn't meant to be making him really villainous and evil and how badass this guy is. It's meant to be the song of, oh, this guy's a narcissistic blowhard.
Okay.
That's the song. It's supposed to be comedic.
Okay.
To be fair.
Is
it comedic? It's still a bad song.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, it's
still
none
of the songs are memorable.
That's
all of them are forgettable.
For Disney, dude.
To be fair, Chris Pine is clearly having fun being a cackling villain.
Okay.
He's pretty good in this and he's obviously having a good time. But other than that, dude, man, it's just nothing.
Oh, that is disappointing.
And the world doesn't make sense. Because the story is this guy, something bad happened. They never explain what happened. Something bad happened to him. And he was like, I'm going to learn magic and be good at magic. And then somehow, because of he's good at magic, he can now grant wishes. So that's his thing. But then he, for some reason, again, never explained, everyone who lives in this kingdom of his, he takes their wish. Because your wish is apparently the thing that makes you you. That's your most important thing.
Okay.
Is your wish.
Okay.
Whatever that is.
Yeah.
Which he then takes from people to keep safe.
Yeah.
And then, so the main character is then going to, is auditioning, so to speak, to become his assistant.
Oh, and it's not his daughter.
No.
Okay.
She's just one of the civilians, so to speak.
Oh, okay.
And he's showing all the wishes that are all kept in these little floating orb things. And she has this realization that, wait a minute, not everyone is going to have their wishes granted. He only grants like a few wishes.
Okay.
And it's like, oh my goodness, most people aren't going to have their wishes granted.
Oh, that's terrible.
No. How does everyone not already know this? Of course, like they've been living there for like 100 years. Of course, most of them would go, oh wait, most wishes, he only grants like 10 wishes or something a year. Most people aren't going to have their wishes granted. So isn't a revelation.
The plot centers around this person seeing that injustice.
Yes.
What?
It makes no sense.
That sounds dumb.
It makes absolutely no sense.
I mean, I'd never got that from the trailer.
None of this movie makes sense.
I knew it was about the bad guy holding people's kind of wishes.
Okay.
But what is the wish? Like a sort of your destiny in life?
No, it's just something you want to do. Like her grandfather wants to like be a musician. That's his wish.
Okay.
And he's keeping this wish. But then when he takes your wish, you forget about it for some reason. You forget what your wish is.
Okay.
Well, that's why you then don't know the injustice of it all, because you don't know that he's...
No, but they know how many people are... Like, there's this big ceremony where he grants someone's wish. He selects, like, one person and he grants their wish.
Okay.
So they would all know most people's wishes aren't going to be granted, because he only does a few a year.
Yes.
It's not like a revelation.
Oh, God. Okay. That sounds... No, well, I can see why this didn't work.
It's such a weird... It's like... the whole thing is, like, there's these little hints here and there that wishes... All the other Disney movies are wishes.
Yes.
So there's a character that's sort of like Peter Pan right at the end. Okay. And there's like one of the wishes you can see has something like he's making like references here. And you're kind of going, okay, I respect them for not making this like an RP parade where they could have just been like all of their movies could have been present here in some way. But at the same time, since that is like a concept in the film, it's barely present. So why do it at all?
Yes.
It makes it's just
my favorite mode is Graham complaining about a movie's logic. It's incredible to watch.
But I don't understand how you started the story where you're talking about you two playing a game and you were saying that what were you bitching about this movie and you forgot that you'd watched it?
No, I wasn't. I was like, okay, I finished watching it.
Yeah.
And I was like, cool, Cole and I are gonna go play Destiny now.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna complain to him about it. By the time we were playing the game, I had forgotten about the movie entirely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Within like a 20-minute period.
The game that we've probably logged 300 hours already playing, so nothing's particularly new or interesting.
Okay.
That was more interesting than Wish.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you guys use this as a chance to just talk? You would have normally spoken about this movie while you were playing the game.
And we talk about whatever comes up, whatever we're watching. Like I was saying to Graham, the crowd is so good. It makes me cry. Like, that's what I said last night.
Yeah. I'd love to see some of the best conversations of people while playing games.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, just a compilation of just the most revelatory moments.
It's like a conversation with someone, with your mom while she's cooking.
Yeah.
Because she's busy doing something
you're
else.
You're focused on something else.
And then the mind's kind of just going because your body is occupied.
Cole's focused on being bad at jumping.
Oh, my God. Don't tell the internet that. I'm a good gamer.
What is the game that you're playing?
Destiny 2.
Okay.
It's so hard to explain.
I don't want to hear it. I'm very
boring. I can give you a brief... Okay, here's a brief summary of Destiny.
Yeah?
Destiny is about...
Star Wars with guns.
No. A space ball that came to Earth and made everyone magic.
Yes.
Now, that is an inadequate explanation.
But perfect.
But technically not wrong.
Technically not wrong. And everyone has guns now. That's the game.
And superpowers.
That's good enough for me.
I started explaining it to Michael yesterday. While he was selling his father's jewelry at Victoria Yards.
Mm-hmm.
And I started explaining Destiny 2 to him, and eventually he said to me, I'm not interested in this. Please stop talking.
That's a good retort to have in your back pocket now. Because now you get to use it at some
Absolutely.
Point as well. But I was thinking about this, just to go on a tangent about video games.
Yeah.
Destiny is like so dense and messy.
Yeah.
I would never recommend it to someone.
Yeah.
If you were going to recommend a game to someone like Russell who's never played video games,
yes.
What do you tell them to play these days?
These days?
Because I feel everything is so dense and so complicated and has so many mechanics.
Oh my God, you're right.
Like, how do you introduce someone who's never played video games to video games?
To a game.
Because you can't, like, you kind of want to lean towards something that, okay, cool, a good story is going to compel them.
Yes.
Red Dead Redemption 2, amazing story. But
no way.
It's such a dense,
how do you
no, heavy game.
There's so much you can do. Yes. So like Russ would just be like, I'm going to go run into a forest and what must I do here?
And then get killed
by a
freaking
cougar.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
It's such a difficult question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Games are so complicated these days.
They have to be complicated. They have to have this huge IP base to adapt movies from or something.
And it feels to me immediately, I'm getting anxious about the fact that like it's going to take so much commitment.
Yes, yes, like a time commitment.
Something simple, right? Yeah.
So I would dive into something that's
Portal.
Oh, Portal. Yeah.
Portal. Portal is the answer.
I'd tell Russell to play Portal.
Because Portal is dead simple.
Yeah.
But it's still like modern enough to be like an introduction to modern games.
Absolutely. So yeah, Portal.
Portal. Maybe we should do that. Let's record Russ playing Portal.
Cool. That's going to be a YouTube video.
Okay.
That would be fun.
Russ would watch me during lockdown playing, and I broke up with my ex.
Yeah.
And I was, well, before and after this breakup.
Yes.
And on the night I broke up with him, Russ said to me, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
Let's watch any movie you want to watch.
Right.
I was like, I want to watch Jaws. Russ was like, yeah, let's watch Jaws. I love that so much. But then after that, I was playing a lot of Dark Souls.
Oh,
and then
right.
I remember Russ like coming into the TV room and watching me playing like 3 hours of Dark Souls.
Right.
And he was like, this game is pretty dark.
Like,
should you be spending so much time playing this? And Russ was like this caring mom that was like, I don't think this is healthy for you.
Let's watch a nice rom-com or something. We were housemates for a good month, 2 or 3 months. Yeah.
It was March until July
right.
of 2020, folks.
2020,
right. So Cole, yeah, got me through lockdown, man.
Ditto.
Yeah.
Yes, dude.
Cool, my boyos.
Yeah.
Nice chatting, nice catching up.
Mm.
Thanks for the lovely day here at the video store.
Yeah.
And thank you to everyone listening thus far. We appreciate you.
We appreciate you.
I think we've got a lovely thing heading our way with this being episode 99.
Oh, yeah.
What?
Next week, as we said at the start, is going to be the 100th episode.
We're 100 episodes
old. Yeah. And I think there's an exciting evolution coming, which I want to just chat just briefly, just a little bit more about now, which is the look to change the format slightly.
Mm.
We've long since spoken about this behind the scenes, but the idea is
behind
that
the counter.
Behind the counter is the fact that, you know, there are these two chats that happen in these 100, you know, the 100 episodes we've done. You've seen the evolution now where there's very much this guest chat which has its own format and themes and ideas, and then there's also the staff chat, the clerks chat we've been doing, and the feeling is that let's try and break those two up entirely so that there's a more focused chat on what's available now, what you can watch now. That's just amongst us as a staff member, here to help you quite functionally figure out what you can watch in a week. So the plan is to put that out on a Tuesday and then the guest chat be on a Thursday, which is something a bit more fun, a bit more relaxed, a bit more timeless in the sense that it could be at any point in time you could maybe listen to that chat. But also if it isn't person who's releasing an album or if a film is coming out, that's usually on Friday, so it's like it's a good chat to have on the night before something's released or the day before something's released. So I think it'll be a fun experiment, and my feeling as we approached 100 episodes was to change the format after 100. That felt like a good time to play with the structure, and you don't know unless you try. So
yeah.
So the feeling is let's give this a go. Let's see what it's like to have two episodes a week. One being the staff episode, which is more functional, as I said, talking about what we're watching now. And then the second one being the guest episode on a Thursday.
Cool.
So let's give it a whirl.
Yeah.
So yeah, just seeding it out into the world now. Let us know what you think of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I really want the staff chat to be more interactive. And I really want to hear more from the folks listening. I really want to interact and engage together more. I've got lots of ideas, which I think we can evolve.
Cool.
Because it'll be standing on its own. And it can be as long as we want it to be.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't think it should be too long, but there's the opportunity to have other customers come in or phone in or talk through or give feedback.
Yeah.
I think it'll be a fun format.
Nice. That sounds rad.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
Cool. All right. So the home base is thevideostore.co.za, and come back again next week, man. It's the 100th episode.
All right.
It's going to be a goodie. And we've got a very special guest.
Nice.
For very special reasons.
Woo!
All right. Cool, guys. Cheers. Cool.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.